Well, patience is a funny thing. And it's even more peculiar in a context in the city, the place we live in, where everything screams at us to be impatient, right? In a culture, a context where everything is hurtling forward, where progress is the name of the game, where making something of ourselves or doing the next best thing is sort of the tenor of our day, to be told to be patient or called to be patient or encouraged toward patience can be a difficult thing. We live in a place that per capita and per sort of metro square footage, our university campuses are plenty. We live in a place where industry is big and tech is always moving forward. We live in a place where life is just busy. And so all throughout the kind of spring and fall here at Hope, you see us sort of dot our calendar with time, opportunities, chances for you and I to get in the same space together, sort of look at one another, take a deep breath and say, let's hold on a minute. Let's press pause. Let's wait together. Let's be patient. Let's see what the Lord might do as we build substantive relationships among one another, as we ask into one another's lives, see how we're really doing. No, I mean how you're really doing, right? All of these types of settings that we get to be in together, we consider them great joy, a great privilege, because in the place that we live, there aren't many contexts, there aren't many opportunities or people that are encouraging us to slow down. Everything is go, go, go. Everything is make more, do more, be better, whatever the message is. For a city so bent on progress and getting ahead and making something of ourselves, it's pretty remarkable then how often we encounter these sort of built-in aspects of our lives that end up challenging us or even teaching us, instructing us in some ways to be patient, to slow down. Within the midst of all the craziness, you and I find ourselves sitting in traffic, right? We find ourselves waiting on the T, waiting on the bus. We find ourselves in conversations with that landlord. We find ourselves in conversations with roommates and loved ones. All of these experiences sort of instructing us, challenging us in regard to our patience. And this is particularly difficult too, as the world sort of breathes impatience when we come to the Word of God. And we find it replete with over and over and over again, encouraging us. Impatience is not the way that we are to wait on the Lord. For people bent on progress, the instruction, the encouragement to wait on God can be difficult to receive. Granted, if you and I are honest with each other, that is hard. And not just for people in this context, but for human beings, period. And so this is our plight. A people who want to make progress, and yet a people who are continually told, encouraged, you've got to wait on God. And we'll see some of that in our passage this morning as we continue in our series in the book of 1 Samuel. If you have a Bible with you, go ahead and turn with me to 1 Samuel. We took a brief break to observe and celebrate Easter events together. Now diving back in and pressing toward an end to our series in 1 Samuel called In Search of a King. In Search of a King. And so this morning we'll be in 1 Samuel. If you don't have a Bible with you, there's one underneath the seat in front of you. You're welcome to use this morning. Feel free to pull that out and use that. Turn to 1 Samuel. And if you don't own a Bible, we as a church would love to give you one. There's a table in the back with a sign that says free Bibles. You can feel free to pick one of those up on your way out this morning. And if you're brand new to reading the Bible, the larger numbers you'll find as you turn to 1 Samuel are chapter numbers. The smaller numbers there are verses, and we'll be in 1 Samuel chapters 26 and 27. So 1 Samuel chapters 26 and 27. So you can follow along silently as I read these two chapters aloud. 1 Samuel 26. Then the Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah, saying, "Is not David hiding himself on the hill of Hiklah, which is on the east of Jeshimon?" So Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph with 3,000 chosen men of Israel to seek David in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul encamped on the hill of Hakalah, which is beside the road on the east of Jeshimon. But David remained in the wilderness. When he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness, David sent out spies and learned that Saul had indeed come. Then David arose and came to a place where Saul had encamped. And David saw the place where Saul lay with Abner, the son of Ner, the commander of his army. And Saul was lying within the encampment while the army was encamped around him. Then David said to Ahimelech the Hittite and to Joab's brother Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, "Who will go down with me into the camp to Saul?" And Abishai said, "I will go down with you." So David and Abishai went to the army by night, and there lay Saul, sleeping within the encampment, with his spear stuck in the ground at his head, and Abner and the army lay around him. Then Abishai said to David, "God has given your enemy into your hand this day. Now please, let me pin him to the earth with one stroke of the spear, and I will not strike him twice." But David said to Abishai, "Do not destroy him, for who can put out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless?" And David said, "As the Lord lives, the Lord will strike him, or his day will come to die, or he will go down into battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should put out my hand against the Lord's anointed. But take now the spear that is at his head and the jar of water, and let us go." So David took the spear and the jar of water from Saul's head, and they went away. No man saw it or knew it, nor did any awake, for they were all asleep, because a deep sleep from the Lord had fallen upon them. Then David went over to the other side and stood far off on the top of the hill with a great space between them. And David called to the army, to Abner the son of Ner, saying, "Will you not answer, Abner?" Then Abner answered, "Who are you who calls to the king?" And David said to Abner, "Are you not a man? Who is like you in Israel? Why then have you not kept watch over your lord, the king? For one of your people came in to destroy the king, your lord. This thing that you have done is not good. As the Lord lives, you deserve to die, because you have not kept watch over your lord, the Lord's anointed. And now see where the king's spear is in the jar of water that was at his head." Saul recognized David's voice and said, "Is this your voice, my son David?" And David said, "It is my voice, my lord, O king." And he said, "Why does my lord pursue after his servant? For what have I done? What evil is on my hands? Now, therefore, let my lord the king hear the words of his servant. If it is the Lord who has stirred you up against me, may he accept an offering. But if it is men, may they be cursed before the Lord. For they have driven me out this day that I should have no share in the heritage of the Lord, saying, 'Go and serve other gods.' Now, therefore, let not my blood fall to the earth away from the presence of the Lord. For the king of Israel has come to seek a single flea like one who hunts a partridge in the mountains." Then Saul said, "I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will no more do you harm, because my life was precious in your eyes this day. Behold, I have acted foolishly and have made a great mistake." And David answered and said, "Here's the spear, O king. Let one of the young men come over and take it. The Lord rewards every man for his righteousness and his faithfulness, for the Lord gave you into my hand today, and I would not put out my hand against the Lord's anointed. Behold, as your life was precious this day in my sight, so may my life be precious in the sight of the Lord, and may he deliver me out of all tribulation." And then Saul said to David, "Blessed be you, my son David. You will do many things and will succeed in them." So David went his way, and Saul returned to his place. 27. Then David said in his heart, "Now I shall perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than that I should escape to the land of the Philistines. And then Saul will despair of seeking me any longer within the borders of Israel, and I shall escape out of his hand." So David arose and went over, he and the 600 men who were with him, to Achish, the son of Maoch, king of Gath. And David lived with Achish at Gath, he and his men, every man with his household, and David with his two wives, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail of Carmel, Nabal's widow. And when it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, he no longer sought him. Then David said to Achish, "If I have found favor in your eyes, let a place be given me in one of the country towns that I may dwell there. For why should your servant dwell in the royal city with you?" So that day Achish gave him Ziklag. Therefore Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah to this day. And the number of the days that David lived in the country of the Philistines was 1 year and 4 months. Now David and his men went up and made raids against the Jerushites, the Gerzites, and the Amalekites, for these were the inhabitants of the land from of old, as far as Shur to the land of Egypt. And David would strike the land and would leave neither man nor woman alive, but would take away the sheep, the oxen, the donkeys, the camels, the garments, and come back to Achish. When Achish asked, "Where have you made a raid today?" David would say, "Against the Negeb of Judah, or against the Negeb of the Jerahmeelites, or against the Negeb of the Kenites." And David would leave neither man nor woman alive to bring news to Gath, thinking, lest they should tell about us and say, "So David has done." Such was his custom all the while he lived in the country of Philistines. And Achish trusted David, thinking, "He has made himself an utter stench to his people Israel. Therefore, he shall always be my servant." So as preparing for the sermon this week, I decided that Curtis and I have delved out passages, but he somehow has slanted the ones to me with all the names I cannot pronounce. So I made do. Jokes aside, in this morning's passage in 1 Samuel 26 and 27, we'll see this encouragement that we are to trust, or that we are to worship the one true God, that we are to worship the one true God even as we wait for him, that we are to worship the one true God even as we wait for him. In chapter 26, we'll see David's concern for worship in the midst of his waiting. His concern for worship in the midst of his waiting. And then in chapter 27, we'll see his self-imposed exile. His self-imposed exile. Worship the one true God, even as we wait for him. As we read through the events unfolding in chapter 26, we might recall, and it's been several weeks since we dealt with chapter 24, but we might recall similarities to the narrative that unfolds in 1 Samuel 24. If you were to hold them up side by side, you would see similar pieces of the narrative unfolding. Different details and obviously different situation, but some of the same principles and concepts, some of the same actions that David is taking, being faced with. It's been a few weeks since we spent time there, but by way of reminder, there in chapter 24, Saul was in pursuit of David, seeking to take David's life. Sound familiar? And David encountered Saul there. Saul was in a precarious position, and David had opportunity to put all of this to an end. All this turmoil, all this chaos that David has been immersed in with Saul chasing after him, seeking to take his life there in 24, David had a ripe opportunity to put Saul to death, to end it all. And we witnessed there how David had an opportunity to usurp God's plans for his life and take into his own hands the promise God gave concerning his status as Israel's future king. As David sits there and watches Saul in this precarious position, he has a legitimate opportunity to take Saul's life and thus work around the plans that God has for unfolding the kingdom before David, for transferring the kingship to David. He has a legitimate opportunity to do so. And yet, in that moment, we remember in 24, David resisted the temptation to go his own way. He chose instead to yield to God's unfolding plan, though he could not actually see what that plan entailed. He could not see exactly how God would bring this plan to fruition. And yet we pointed out in chapter 24 that there David trusted the Lord, despite what he could not see. I know the Lord is up to something. I'm not going to lay my hand on the Lord's anointed. I'm going to let him take care of the situation. Here, Saul has been in pursuit of David with several thousand men in tow. David is able to figure out where Saul and his men have set up camp. And David and one of his own men, Abishai, spy on Saul, and we see David confronted again with the opportunity to take Saul's life. So if we took this section of 1 Samuel, we thought about 24 and the situation that's going down and David resisting sin in the moment, resisting the opportunity to take things into his own hand. We couple that with chapter 25 that Curtis preached through 2 weeks ago, and we remember Abigail helping restrain David from sinning in that way. And then now we observe these events in 26, we see example after example of God's sovereign and gracious purposes being brought forth as David, time after time, resists giving in to bringing things about his own way. So all of these things coupled together, we see demonstrated here David's resistance, his refusal to take things into his own hands. And now David and Abishai are spying out Saul. They see where he's encamped, and we see David confronted again with the opportunity to take Saul's life, putting an end to the threat on his own life. And let's be honest, if he were to do so, it could perhaps hasten the transition, bring him out as king, give him the very thing that God has promised him. Why not take it now? Would hasten this transition to the kingship of Israel, the very thing that God had promised, the very thing that God told David would happen, is right before him. The temptation in this instance comes by way of Abishai, his colleague, his friend who's with him. Verse 8, then Abishai said to David, God has given your enemy into your hand this day. Now please, let me pin him to the earth with one stroke of the spear. And hey, David, if that doesn't sound good enough, if putting all of this to an end, I won't even need to strike twice. Just once, and it's all over. The path of least resistance, the way of ease, the thing you most want, the thing you most desire, this is how easy it could be, David. No turmoil at all. But we want to note here, as we have in chapters before, David's response, and again, the reason why David responds the way he does, given the easy way out, given the clear path before him. See David's response, verse 9. But David said in response to Abishai, do not destroy him. For who can put out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? And David said, as the Lord lives, the Lord will strike him, or his day will come to die, or he'll go down to battle and perish. Verse 11, the Lord forbid that I should put my hand out against the Lord's anointed. But take now the spear that is at his head and the jar of water and let us go. And so we bear witness here again to David, resisting, restraining himself from sinning in this way by stepping out before the Lord. Again, David is insistent upon prioritizing the Lord's plans despite the unfavorable circumstances he finds himself in day after day, week after week, month after month now. Things are looking bleak. I'm fearful. I'm on the run constantly. I'm more than uncomfortable. And none of these to this point is justification for David to move one step before the Lord, to move ahead of what God has for him. Don't touch the Lord's anointed. This is the man that God has in place. I'm to be the man, but for now, this is the way things are. I'm content to let the Lord work in the ways that he has chosen. David is aware that Saul is the one whom the Lord has chosen, that even the situation that endangers his very life is not a circumstance that God is unaware of or that God's not involved in. He recognizes God's attentiveness to and in the situation. And not only is David aware of God's hand in the matter, the whole situation here in 1 Samuel 26, it's sort of enveloped for us in reminders of God's sovereignty and his care, of God's power and his control, and yet being all-powerful and completely in control, that God still cares for his situation. This is true for David, and it's true for us, that this belief we have that God is absolutely in control is also a comfort for us. We don't need a God who is in less control than our God is if we're to be supremely comforted. We need a God who's absolutely in control, who's well aware of the details of our lives, who's well aware of everything that's unfolding, who's working all things for his glory, for the good of those who love him, who are called according to his purpose. This whole chapter is enveloped in reminders of this God and his sovereign care. As David and Abishai move to take the spear and the water jar, these sort of reminders, memorials, evidences that they could have indeed taken Saul's life, as they move in to take these two pieces from beside Saul's head, everyone in the camp stays asleep. Evidences of God's sovereign care over a situation. No one hears what happens. No one sees what's going on. Out of thousands and thousands of people, a miracle happens. No, really, a miracle. The text says that God caused a deep sleep. It's a miracle that's unfolding in this narrative. God preserving his plan and his ways and his people and his story. causing these people to stay and remain in a deep sleep. After making off with the spear and the water bucket, I said water like a South Georgian or something, a water bucket, David and Abishai depart from the camp and confront Saul, his commander Abner, and the rest of the army from afar. David chides Abner here, and we see this sort of interaction between David and the commander of the army. And we see here David reminding Abner that he is insufficient for his task, sort of relentlessly chiding Abner. Abner, this man who is Saul's right-hand man, who's meant to protect Saul in the midst of the camp of these thousands and thousands of people, has now failed on the job. That David and Abishai have come in and taken this water bucket, and they have taken this spear. And David reminds Abner of every bit of that process, chiding him here for his inattentiveness in keeping Saul safe. And we have here, more could be said, but we have at the very least here sort of a microcosm, a small picture of what's happening more broadly in the nation of Israel and throughout the story of 1 Samuel. We have here a microcosm of God's unfolding plan, because the man who sits at Saul's right hand, the man who seems, for all intents and purposes, to be the one who could take Saul's place, is now failing at the job that he's been given. And David is keen to remind him, Abner, you have one job. You failed to do it. The text makes evident here that the man who seems likely to sort of be a stand-in for Saul is not the one who's chosen by God. We're reminded in the text that David will be the rightful successor, that God's plan is sure and will continue to unfold. And as he did in chapter 24, David here pleads his case to Saul, presenting to him all the reasons why Saul should not chase after him, reminding him that there's no good reason that Saul should seek to take his life. He's done nothing wrong. He doesn't represent a sincere threat to Saul. Why are you chasing me? Verses 17 through 21 capture, too, an interesting aspect of David's concern. Let's look at that part of the passage again, starting in verse 17. Paying attention here to this aspect of David's concern in the midst of the threat. Verse 17, Saul recognized David's voice and said, "Is this your voice, my son David?" as he had been calling out to Abner. And David said, "It is my voice, O Lord, my king," or "my lord, O king." 18, and he said, "Why does my lord pursue after his servant? For what have I done? What evil is on my hands? Now, therefore, let my lord the king hear the words of his servant." Hear this. "If it is the Lord who has stirred you up against me, may he accept an offering. But if it is men, may they be cursed before the Lord. For they have driven me out this day that I should have no share in the heritage of the Lord, saying instead, 'Go serve other gods.' Now, therefore," 20 says, "let not my blood fall to the earth away from the presence of the Lord. For the king of Israel has come out to seek a single flea like one who hunts a partridge in the mountains." And then Saul said, "I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will no more do you harm because my life was precious in your eyes this day. Behold, I have acted foolishly and have made a great mistake." Essentially, in this part of the passage, David is saying, if the Lord is the one sending you after me, Saul, then I need to take up things with the Lord. If that's what's going on here, Saul, if he has actually set you after me, then that's where my problem is. And that's what I'm going to have to do. Maybe he'll accept a sacrifice. Maybe that's how we can get along in figuring out a solution to this. But, David says to Saul, if this is a man-made concern, if this is something you or someone else has fashioned of your own accord and come up with your own to seek after my life in this way, then you or whoever else is responsible will be dealt with by God accordingly. And here's why, David says. He says it's because he won't be able to continue worshiping God in the way that God is worthy to be worshiped. And the way this is phrased in our text is he's going to continue putting me out of the places, the spaces where I can worship God as he ought to be worshiped. With the encouragement, move out from this land and go worship someone else. And so David here, with the threat on his own life, amid this great threat that would cost him everything, David's here in his waiting for this to be resolved, for this problem to be taken care of. David's concern is worship. In the middle of his waiting, in the middle of his angst, in the middle of his worry, in the middle of the threat, David's concern here is that he won't be able to worship God in the way that he ought. David's concern is worship in the midst of his waiting. And so is ours. And so is ours. As we watch David sort of fumble through this reasoning with Saul, we note here from Saul a similar response that we see in chapter 24. David basically has said, "You want my life, Saul, but there is one who is worthy of my worship. He's the object of my focus now." And we see that Saul gives in, at least for the moment. Saul, for the moment, relents. And in verses 21 through 25, we see Saul's confession and an apology and David's recognition of the Lord's blessing in his life on account of his faithfulness. David says, "I have been faithful, and the Lord has blessed me." We want to be careful as readers of Scripture in our day not to take this as prescriptive, but as descriptive, describing what David is now recognizing. He has been faithful, and he is now recognizing that the Lord is continuing to be faithful and bless his life. There's no instruction here given to us. We should say plainly that every ounce and every moment of our faithfulness will deserve and get reward in the next breath. This isn't an equation that David is somehow laying over onto our modern Christian lives. Rather, David in this moment, as we observe him in real time, David is recognizing, "I was faithful. I was faithful to remember the Lord's purposes. And now my eyes are wide open. To his blessing in my life, my eyes are wide open to the ways he has been faithful and continues to be faithful in my life. I can see it all clearly. I can see it all clearly." David recognizes the Lord's blessing in his life on account of his faithfulness. And so we see this kind of one side of David, recognizing the Lord's plan unfolding in his life, deferring to the Lord instead of his own wishes. And yet it's coupled here at the end of the chapter and ongoingly so in chapter 27 with another side of David. Immense amounts of trust and faith and belief. It's like when you did your quiet time every day last week and all the birds are singing and the sun came out. It's that kind of moment. Everything's going right. And then at the end of 27, we see in a moment how things, or at the end of 26, we see in a moment how things begin to turn. David went his way, and Saul returned to his place in the first verse of 27. Then David said in his heart, after all this reminder of God's faithfulness and blessing and all of these things that are sort of lighting up David's life, the first verse of 27, then David said in his heart, he said to himself, "Now I shall perish one day by the hand of Saul. And there's nothing better for me than that I should escape to the land of the Philistines. And then Saul will despair of seeking me any longer within the borders of Israel, and I shall escape out of his plan." And so we see here sort of the polar ends of David's life, a picture here of what faith and unbelief can look like, the tension that you and I probably deal with from time to time, if we're honest. This tension between everything seems to be panning out. I feel particularly equipped to put sin to death and battle sin in the ways that I ought. And yet, on a given day, hope lingers. Faith is hard to come by. And trust is difficult to have. Because of the obstacles in front of me, they're mounting, and they seem to be impenetrable. We find here two sides of David. And what begins to unfold in 27 is sort of the ramifications of David talking to himself. This is the only way out. This is the only way that I have to go. David begins to grow fearful in light of the threat upon his life. And for reasons that may seem more obvious to us, based on our own experiences and how we might fashion ourselves in his situation, the light of God's rescue and the reminder of God's utter faithfulness to David begin to grow dim compared to the looming threat that's before him. To the end of 26, the entirety of chapter 27 recount David's fear, the beginning, for his own life and his eventual exile, this sort of self-imposed exile among the Philistines. Sensing Saul will not relent, will not give up chasing him, David chooses to remove himself, traveling back to Gath. We remember Gath from his story. And there befriending the son of the king, now under the guise of one who was fighting not with the Israelites, but against them. And here, having been granted land to live in, to dwell in, David and his men begin to conduct raids on neighboring groups. Every time they go out fighting these groups, putting them to death, these names of these groups we will not repeat again in this context. David and his men charging out into battle. And we note here a small detail sort of underlying the text, that though this seems to be David's own plan, that every enemy that he's taking off the list just happens to be a common enemy of the Philistines and of Israel. And so we see in the text here that David begins to do some of his own bidding. If he's to be the king of Israel, surely this will go well toward his reign and his rule. Surely this will help him out in the end. And so this is what's happening. This is what's occurring. He's convinced this military leader. He's now on their side, and this is where David will hang out for the next few chapters, and we'll watch his story kind of unfold under the rule and in the company of the Philistines as he's pretending to fight on their side while vying for Israel all the while. We see in the text that he is not honest with the military leader when the military leaders ask, "Who are you conducting these raids against?" And he tells a bit of a half-truth, telling them, "I'm generally attacking this group in this general region," and not specifying who it is, for they'll know in real time. We say a half-truth, but we would also call that, reasonably, a lie. And we see here, don't we, the two sides of David. Immense amounts of faith and trust and belief in the Lord's goodness and what he's done in my life. I've got to get out of here, and I'm going to lie in the midst of it. These two sides of David, we've said from week to week that David is a pointer to, that he images forth for us not only his kingship that's coming, but a king who is to come. That David is a pointer to Jesus. It's his actual lineage that's going to point us and bring to us a savior of the whole world. But we've said week after week as well that David does this imaging forth imperfectly. If he were to check every box and do this perfectly, would there be any need for Jesus at all? And so we see here a shadow of this Christ who is to come. David imaging forth Jesus in manifold ways and trusting his life to God's will and God's plan. We've talked about this over the last week in celebrating Good Friday, observing Easter together. Jesus himself submitted to the Father's plan. Not my will, but your will be done. Into your hands, Father, I commit my spirit. Jesus yielding, giving us this exemplary demonstration of humility for us. Sacrificing his life on our behalf, deferring his own will to the Father's will so that he could come and die, pay the price for your sin and for my sin. And all of David's life, all of his camping out in the utter faithfulness, the utter goodness of his God is pointing us to that man, the one who hung on the cross, the one who died for your sin and for mine. And yet, he does this imperfectly. And we see in this other side of David this fearfulness that grows and this maybe this desire to take things in his own hand. We want to be mindful, even looking at the text clearly, on its surface and then in its detail. We want to be mindful here that in chapter 27, there is no moral judgment from the author on anything that's occurring. He doesn't say once that the Lord instructed David to do this. He doesn't tell us either that the Lord told David not to. He doesn't say that this is a very good God thing. He doesn't say that this is a very bad sin thing. Makes no judgment on it. And so we should be slow to as well. Commentator after commentator has wrestled with this text. Why did David do what he did? And some are persuasive in their arguments. None are conclusive. All agree that what we have here is a picture of an imperfect man who in manifold ways shows us Jesus, but who ultimately comes up short. The crazy thing about David's experience, the crazy thing about him wrestling in this way, the crazy thing about the tension that we see David kind of experiencing in his own life is that I think if we didn't think too long about it, we might be reminded in David's tension a lot of ourselves. How in one moment I feel particularly keen to worship God with every bit of who I am, and I'm sensitive to his ways and his promises. I'm sensitive to all the things that the Lord is telling me or asking of me. I'm sensitive to these things. And in the very next, I'm willing and wanting and desirous of taking things into my own hands, of making things happen my own way, of forcing my own desire and my own will and my own want above, prioritizing these things above the wishes of God and what he wants for me. We recognize in David this tension that is quite familiar to us, this wrestling that David has in his heart. And so what do we glean from the text? That we could spend hours talking about detail after detail after detail here in 1 Samuel 26 and 27. What do we glean from the text? The sort of overriding, undergirding, all-encompassing theme. As we watch David wrestle back and forth, belief and unbelief, but coming to grips with the reality that in his waiting for God's plan to unfold, that he's going to have to worship, that he's going to have to trust, that he's going to have to see to it he's in a position where he can trust that God is sovereign, that God is in control, and that God is attentive to and cares about his situation. So as we think about what it means to worship in our waiting, I want to end today and push towards a close, just offering a few things. Again, not all-encompassing or pervasive description of what this actually looks like for us, but some encouragement this morning for you and for me. Because it won't be long again before you and I are waiting. Perhaps that's you right now. And I don't know what that looks like for you. I don't know what that has looked like for you. Some of you I do. But it's a very real possibility that in a room this size with this many people that you are waiting for something that you believe the Lord has in store for you. And that waiting season is impossibly difficult. It's impossibly difficult. And we want to speak really to those kinds of situations, not ignore them and pretend that we can kind of come into this space and worship together, sort of ignoring all the more difficult areas and aspects of our lives, but acknowledge this is not easy. Command after command to trust the Lord, to put our hope in the Lord. What does it all mean? How do we do it? A couple of things as we push for a close. A couple of things that inform our posture as we begin to learn and experience what it means to worship God even as we wait for him to act. A couple of things that inform not just what are we going to do when we're faced with suffering and temptation and trial and ongoing wishes that are not granted and ongoing prayers that seem unanswered, not just what we do, but a couple of things that help us answer the question, who are we going to be when we're waiting? Not just what will we do, but who are we going to be? Who is God fashioning us into amid these kinds of trials, amid this kind of suffering, amid this kind of heaviness? What is God up to? So things that may be evident in your life in a season of waiting and that tend toward honoring God in the way that he ought to be honored. The first is this, that we wait in humility. That we wait in humility. What does it mean to wait in humility? A simplest way of putting is waiting, undergirding, making, proclaiming, making the confession that I'm waiting and I do not know everything. I can't see it all. I don't have all the details. I don't know the next step in the plan. I don't know 10 steps after that. I can't see it all. My perspective, my thoughts, my vision, all of it's limited. This is the kind of humility we're after. The confession that I don't know everything, but I know one who does. And if my God is one who knows it all, he's omniscient, that he's all-knowing, if my God is that God, then I can take great solace in my waiting. And I can watch my waiting bleed into worship as I humble myself before an all-knowing God and I confess to him with my life, I can't see it all, but you can. And because you can, you are worthy of my worship. I don't know the next step. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know the outcome, but you do. You do. When life has not yielded what we thought it would, hasn't produced all the things we expected, a natural question we're faced with is how will we respond? Who will we be? Will we be humble people, able to confess in that moment, I'm given to angst. I can't see it all, but I trust, Lord, that you do. One author puts it this way, that humility subverts impatience by gladly admitting how little we can see in any given moment, however difficult or inconvenient that moment may be. John Piper says it this way, God is always doing 10,000 things in your life, and you may be aware of 3 of them. He is always up to something. Will we be humble enough to admit that we're short-sighted and that he's all-knowing? A second thing that sort of informs our posture, if humility subverts impatience by admitting how little we can see, then faith subverts impatience by reminding us of what God has promised us. And so we approach our seasons of waiting and turn those into worship by demonstrating, asking the Lord to help us exhibit humility and faith. Humility says we can't see it all, and faith says remember what you've been promised. Remember that the Lord is out for your good if you love him. What has God promised? One among many promises in Scripture, Isaiah 40, verse 31, but those who wait upon the Lord will what? Will renew their strength. This is a promise from God, that those who wait upon God will renew their strength. They will mount up with wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and they will not faint. This promise for God, he will uphold you, brother and sister. Promise after promise after promise that informs our waiting and turns it into worship. If God has promised me that, I can trust him. That in the moment, the hour of my waiting, that in the moment of my weakness, he'll renew my strength in that moment. That when I feel down, that he'll mount me up. When I feel tired, he'll allow me to run and I won't grow weary. When I feel faint, he'll allow me to put one foot in front of the other. Trustworthy step after trustworthy step. All for his glory and for our good. As we seek to demonstrate humility and faith in these ways as a means of worshiping God in our waiting, we have more practical helps at our disposal as well. The people around you, for instance. How glorious is this truth that God has not sent you to be alone, or has not made it so that you are alone, even in a waiting season? And it's possible in a place like this, to feel like you maybe are unknown and that kind of thing. But some encouragement here to raise our awareness of those to our left and to our right, in front of, behind. We are surrounded by people who have been given a command by the Lord to bear one another's burdens. We are trapped. We have to do it. In a season of waiting, lean on your brother. Lean on your sister. This is what God has given us, the local church, as a means of accomplishing, that we have one another to build up our faith, to walk with us as we're humbled. This morning, as a means of ending the sermon and giving a time for response, I wanted to do something a little off kilter, but I just want to read a passage of scripture for you. Just to remind you this morning of the promises of God that you might meditate on, dwell upon for just a moment. As we look through the Psalms, we have effectively what are David and others' prayer journal. As a matter of fact, throughout 1 Samuel, as we preach throughout 1 Samuel, you could turn to the Psalms and you could find many Psalms with an inscription at the top of them that say, David wrote this Psalm when he was in X situation, which occurred in 1 Samuel. And over again, we are allowed these layers that are peeled back in David's life as he's processing and thinking about the truths of God while he's in the midst of deep, deep turmoil. This morning, we don't have a psalm that comes particularly from Psalm or 1 Samuel 26 or 27, but we do have Psalm 62, and I wanted to read this just for you to kind of sit up under and to consider this morning as we take a moment of silence here at the end of the service for reflection this morning. I don't know what kind of season of waiting you're in. It may be things that you've never expressed to anyone. It may be things that you feel like you've expressed to people too much. But the kind of shame and maybe the resistance that comes to honestly sharing whatever that is, honestly giving whatever that is to the Lord to help you, to come alongside, to bless you with this sort of humility and trusting posture that we're talking about, whatever it is that gets us in that space, I'm banking this morning on God's word being a great help to you. Perhaps this morning the waiting for you is that you would profess, you would say in this place that you don't know Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior. Week after week, you come into this place and you hear this word preached and you hear the good news of Jesus' life, his death, and his resurrection. And week after week, you make your way back out the door, having heard that again and yet not responded. Perhaps that's the season of waiting for you. If you have questions along those lines, we would love to have a conversation with you. You are welcome in this space with us. Perhaps on the Connect card we mentioned earlier, you might write some of those questions. Are there a couple of prompts there for you to consider as well? We would love for you to get to know this Jesus that we so often proclaim, so joyfully proclaim in this place. For believers in the room, the application point at risk of me just repeating myself week after week that I get an opportunity to be up here, I would love for us together to sink our teeth into this truth about our God. Psalm 62, 1 through 8 reads, "For God alone, my soul waits in silence. From him comes my salvation. He alone is my rock and my salvation. My fortress, I should not greatly be shaken." How long will all of you attack a man to batter him like a leaning wall, a tottering fence? They only plan to thrust him down from his high position. They take pleasure in falsehood. They bless with their mouths, but inwardly they curse. Listen, for God alone, oh, my soul, wait in silence, for my hope is from him. He only is my rock and my salvation, my fortress. I shall not be shaken. On God rests my salvation and my glory, my mighty rock, my refuge. Hear this, brother and sister. My refuge is God. Trust in him at all times, O people, and pour out your heart before him. Hear this, that God is a refuge for us. This morning, as we take a moment just to reflect, a moment of silence, let's consider together what that might mean for us in our seasons of waiting, how we might be of help to our brothers and sisters found there as well, that God is a refuge for us, that he is a place we run. He's a place we run. Let's take a moment of silence. I'll pray, and we'll observe and take the Lord's Supper together.